It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The latest infrastructure bill in Congress includes $45 billion to address lead pipes. Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority is working to find and replace the existing ones following its own timeline, a strict one, that is. If the infrastructure bill is passed, could federal funds change how the city is dealing with its pipes? With us is Will Pickering, CEO of PWSA. Will, good to have you back on the show.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Kevin.
So PWSA has this goal to replace all the city's lead service lines by the end of 2026. Where are you toward meeting that plan?
Really, when we're replacing lead lines, we are identifying where they are at the same time as we are attempting to replace them. So we do not have a precise count of exactly how many lead lines we have in our system, though we have made several estimates, and that estimate has gotten better. So to date, we have replaced about 8,500 lead lines on the public side. That's the portion of the service line that PWSA owns. And along with that, we've replaced approximately 5,500 private lines. Our latest estimates say that we're about halfway there, and that's why we're continuing our program full steam ahead.
To clarify, you're still finding lead service lines at this point?
That is correct. We have undergone a document search project where we digitized all of the what we call our historic records to determine what at least the lead lines, where they were at the time of construction. But as you can imagine, things have changed over the last 100 years or so when many of the homes here in our service area were built. Often if a record says that there was lead, we'll go ahead and excavate and we find that the lead had been replaced or maybe it was never installed to begin with. So it's an imperfect record that we're working on now. That has gotten refined through the help of a statistical analysis program that we underwent with the University of Pittsburgh, as well as just finding the odds based on property age. We're looking at trends in the areas where we have excavated these service lines. So it still is an estimate.
Mm-hmm. So approximately halfway done. And remind us, when did you start the replacement process?
In earnest, we really began in 2016, but things didn't pick up until the 2017 time period. So the bulk of those 8,500 public lead service lines that we replaced were from the late 2017 time period moving forward into this construction season, where we're replacing lead service lines through our water main replacement program right now this summer.
Give us an idea. Approximately how many people, how many buildings get their water through lead lines these days?
Well, currently we're estimating that around 8,000 or so may still have lead service lines in place. We are responsible for that public side of the lead line. Our data is a little better there, so our estimate is a little bit better. Most commercial properties, just because of the nature of the construction and needing a larger diameter service line, most commercial properties do not have lead service lines. So usually when we're performing replacements, they're on single family homes, not larger apartment buildings. That's not to say that it doesn't exist. So we have about 80,000 water service connections in PWSA's service area. And again, we think, you know, somewhere about 8,000 may still have lead lines in place. And that's why we're committing to replacing them all by that goal of 2026. And we're hopeful that we might even be able to expedite that with the help of federal funding.
Mm-hmm. So should Congress pass this infrastructure bill, approximately, do you have any idea how much PWSA would be eligible for?
It's really probably too early to say. We are a large public water system, and from everything that we have gathered through following the actions on Capitol Hill, we think that we would be eligible for a decent proportion of that to be able to replace the remaining bit of service lines in place in our water system. And I think it's also an area we'd like to explore is that we've already spent $100 million to date on replacing these lead service lines. It would be excellent if Congress would give us the flexibility to sort of pay ourselves for that work that we have already undergone, because we're really ahead of the game when you look at other cities and their lead line replacement programs. So that might be one way that we could creatively pay ourselves back for the work that we've done to date and use that additional budget availability to focus on other areas of our water system that need investment as well.
Would the extra funding, if you get it, enable you to meet that goal of the end of 2026, replacing all these lead lines, maybe a little earlier?
It certainly could, Kevin. Right now, our plans are designed around a program where we're replacing lead lines as we replace water mains. And so, looking at it from a construction perspective, that is likely the most efficient way to go about it. However, if there were additional federal funding dollars available, we could do the water main replacement program and then expedite things through a focused lead service line program, more targeted on neighborhoods, which was really what we did on a property by property basis over the previous 3 years or so. Importantly, those are dollars that we wouldn't have to ask from our ratepayers. So it would offset the need for some of the future rate increases that we would expect to be in front of us. So we'd get, we'd improve water quality, improve the state of our system, and keep rates at a relatively lower rate than we would have otherwise had to if we were funding this just through contributions from our customers.
When you talk to your counterparts in other cities, I mean, they're going through this as well in many cities. So considering how widespread lead is in water lines, do you think $45 billion in this bill is enough?
By all estimates, it is likely not enough, which, it sounds like a staggering figure, though there is a lot of lead across the United States in older cities in water systems. Any dollar is welcomed by the water utility community. I want to make sure that's loud and clear. However, there likely is even more expense than that $45 billion amount.
What's the costliest part of replacing lead lines, Will?
Believe it or not, it's the construction related to restoring the street and the sidewalk. So anytime that we are replacing a lead service line, it requires us to dig a hole at the water main. We try to make that hole fairly small, and then we also have to excavate typically in the sidewalk where that public and private portion of the line meet, and there's a valve. And, excavating there and then replacing it to a brand new condition is very expensive. PWSA in the last few years has paved as much, if not more, than the city of Pittsburgh. So, we do return to our sites and pave curb to curb and replace sidewalk pads, which are, typically the property owner's responsibility. And those dollars add up.
You introduced a program in November that reimburses customers up to 100% of the cost of replacing the section of service lines on their property. So far, about how many people have taken advantage of that?
I don't have the latest numbers at the tip of my fingers right now, Kevin, but we are certainly interested in more people enrolling. I know it is not over 50 customers, so it is something that over the years, we have heard customers who are really interested in sort of jumping the line and taking their own initiative to replace the service line on their end. And we now have an opportunity for them to, like you said, perhaps get all of it paid for by PWSA. So we do want to encourage customers to look into that. And if there is a public side of the line that's made of lead, we'll have our crews out there working with the private plumber and get all of that new pipe installed. So it really is a great program. It's a relatively new offering.
Yeah, how costly would that be for the the private homeowner to replace the lead line that's actually on their property, from curb into their house?
Typically, it's multiple thousands of dollars. Some of it depends on, Pittsburgh, we're one of the reasons we're in such a beautiful city is our topography, but it can make construction projects when people like myself live on the high side of a block. Running that pipe can be a little bit more expensive, and depending on where the water main is, you might have to disrupt a little more in the street. But it's easily, $5,000 to $10,000 worth of work if you were to undertake it on your own.
The amount one is reimbursed is based on income, so lower income families could get 100% of the cost covered, but the more you make, obviously, the less is covered. Would you be permitted by the federal government to use federal funds to make more people eligible for full reimbursement?
I think that's something that we would definitely want to look into, Kevin. You know, our commitment is to replace all of the lead service lines. So whether that work is performed through the customer taking that initiative or whether it's our contractors, you would have to read the details of any federal funding package. But, you know, whatever it takes, we are constantly looking at other utilities to find out what they're doing and directing additional federal funding to a program like ours to broaden the eligibility makes a lot of sense to me.
Will Pickering is the CEO of Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority. Will, thanks so much for your time.
Anytime, Kevin.
With your hour's wage of 14 cents, we pay the butcher, the store, the rent. When payday's done, the money's spent with little to put by. And if the work slows down again, they'll cut back turns for day wage men. And though I've taken boarders in, it's a struggle to get by.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. 129 years ago this week, the Battle of Homestead was waged at the Andrew Carnegie-owned Homestead Steel Plant that set back organized labor, at least in the growing steel industry, for at least three decades. Charles McAllister is a labor historian and one of the founders of the Battle of Homestead Foundation. Charlie, welcome to The Confluence.
It's good to be here.
To set the stage, what were the conditions working in a steel plant almost 130 years ago?
That's what I think is largely misunderstood. Homestead in 1892 was the workers. It was not a depressed area. It was not a dirty mill. It was a brand new, state-of-the-art, best mill in the world. It was the Workers' Republic. They had a union contract from 1889. The union was involved in every decision on the shop floor. For one thing, they didn't work on Sundays. Their hours were set by the type of work they did. So if you worked the open hearth, it would take between 8 and 12 hours. You stayed with the heat. And critically, before the strike, they were paid based on the tonnage produced. Then the money was divided up by the union according to skill and seniority. And they were trying to keep that type of system, which had a lot of worker input. They were trying to maintain that at Homestead. So that's what they were fighting about. And they were making very good money because their wages were linked to the incredibly exploding production of steel, which was being made possible by the Bessemer and open hearth furnaces.
The dispute between the union and management, the CEO, Henry Clay Frick, not exactly a union sympathizer.
No.
Was it a take-it-or-leave-it proposition?
Yeah, Frick, once he got rid of Carnegie to Scotland and out of the way, because he feared for Carnegie's desire to be loved by everybody, then Andrew went along with it and gave, you know, with a wink. I mean, he knew that this was not going to go well, but Frick's interest was control of the work process. He hated it when busybodies from the Amalgamated Association could challenge what engineers and what he was laying out on the shop floor. They would come, they would want to know how many men are going to work here, who's going to hire them, how are they going to be hired. What Carnegie was interested in breaking was the link to production, because he understood the incredible multiplier that steel was making. But they still made extraordinary wages. The top roller at Homestead before the strike made $12 a day, which was a princely sum. Ordinary wages in the 19th century were $1 a day, 60 cents a day for women, and to make $5 to $8 for the skilled, $2 for the lowest laborers. It was the best paid place to work. It was a union place. The town was controlled by the union.
So,
but after the battle, everything changed radically. They instituted the 12-hour day, 7-day week, which was 84 hours as opposed to 50 or 60 under the union. Unions always had Sunday off. Sunday was wiped out. And the link between production and pay was broken. But the worst of all to me, and very seldom mentioned, around the turn of the century, they instituted the universal swing shift, which is where you get the 24-hour long turn every 2 weeks, where people had to work. That never happened under the union. The swing shift removed people, from the involvement in the community, from or any of the issues that affected the local community, the steelworkers were completely taken out of it until 1937.
There was a battle, and this wasn't just of wills, but a battle with rifles, even cannon, between hired security, the Pinkertons, and workers, left 10 people dead, many injured, National Guard called in to disperse the strikers. So why did this battle and the final resolution not just change what happened in Homestead, but hamper unionization for years to come?
Well, it was incredibly dramatic. It was visible. I mean, it's estimated at least 10,000 people witnessed the battle from the hillsides across the river and on the battle side. The two barges with 300 men with Winchester rifles, less than half of them were official Pinkertons. The other half, some of them were students who were hired for what they were told was guard duty at an industrial facility, had no idea what they were walking into or sailing into. But the two barges came up and under some light fire initially. So from particularly around 8 o'clock, the Pinkertons opened up with major fire, and the gun battle really took off. By mid-afternoon or 2 or 3 o'clock, their workers had gone and got dynamite and other things, and the union said, we've got to take control of this, back control of this. So the union came in around 3, began to quiet their, reestablish control over the workers, and at 4:30, 5 o'clock, the Pinkertons accepted the Pinkertons, who had been waving a white flag for a while. And then the Pinkertons came out of the barges, and they were rudely treated. The union leaders marched in front with an American flag gauntlet, and they beat the hell out of the Pinkertons on their way to being secured in the music hall. And then the union decided to ship them out on the midnight train, because they couldn't guarantee that they weren't going to get killed.
Charlie, do you think it would have made any difference if other Carnegie-owned steel plants had been unionized at the time?
Well, a bunch of them tried. I mean, there were sporadic strikes around the Homestead thing, but Homestead was really the cutting edge, because its technology was the most advanced. It had both Bessemer and particularly basic open hearth technologies, which were really the cutting edge. The Mon Valley by the 1890s was equal in production to Great Britain. And there certainly were other places where unions were much stronger, but they had completely controlled iron. Iron production in the United States, all through the Civil War, you imagine all that artillery and all those weaponry was done by puddlers making 100 pounds at a time, where the Homestead mill was making hundreds of tons at a time. The jump in productivity was it was a revolution in how people were going to live, and so it changes everything. But it shifts the power so dramatically into the hands of these wealthy owners that the standards set at Homestead for worker control really become the gold standard from their point of view in terms of labor relations, and they become imitated virtually everywhere until the great upsurge of the 1930s.
So, what's the importance of this battle and strike in the larger context of labor relations and union history, not only in the 1890s, not only up to the 1930s, but through the decades and even today?
Well, it seems to me, you know, I used to always marvel at different talks that I would give, especially to more business type, or you're making all these kids go to school, to college, but you don't give them a voice in the workplace. One of the critical issues was a voice in the workplace, was the ability to bargain for your wages and your working conditions, you know. And now we're facing a situation where people are really facing, are you going to work at home or are you going to work at work? Are you going to go into a particular place? It's very useful if you have people on the other side of the table who've been elected by their peers, who can help work your way through these issues in an intelligent fashion if you're willing to do that. But the American response generally is management control, and total control was achieved at U.S. Steel, and it was devastating to U.S. Steel. U.S. Steel was incredibly, Carnegie Steel was incredibly innovative as long as it had to deal with high-paid labor. As soon as it crushed high-paid labor and virtually cut the wages in half, they ended up just sitting on their technology and making money. And that was devastating in the long run. The lack of a worker voice, the lack of any democracy in the workplace in the 1930s gave workers citizenship, but it did not give them a voice in investment decisions and in how the workplace is organized, which is what they have in Europe, really, with the works councils and all of the industries of Europe. And in Japan, workers have much more say. Of course, in Germany, 50% of the management board is elected by union people. Who's doing better in manufacturing? I mean, to exclude the worker, especially now that we've insisted that they all get college degrees, which, I mean, I have a PhD in philosophy, but I also work with my hands, and I think the two are equal. They're just different types of knowledge. But there is a great lesson here. Letting workers in, involving them in partnerships, dealing with them in terms of contracts where you define what the joint responsibilities and relationships are, can be very useful. Obviously, it can be terrible when it turns into bitter enmity and you try to destroy each other. But when it works, it's really a much better system, as most of Europe, Japan have determined.
Charles McAllister is a labor historian and one of the founders of the Battle of Homestead Foundation. Charlie, thanks so much for your time.
It was a great pleasure.
To help them raise their pay. If not, you'll work in steel no more, your name wiped off the slab.
Music for our story about the 1892 Homestead Steel Strike was recorded by Annie Trimble for the centennial of that historic event.
America, land of the free, is not better than...
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Rebecca Reese, Owen Trainer, Laura Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.